On this week's COVID Race and Democracy is the first of what will be four shows on imperialism, which is an advanced stage of capitalism where the few wealthiest and most powerful nations use violence or coercion to capture the land, resources, and labor power from the rest of the world for their own benefit.
The U.S. military is the top consumer of petroleum around, burning more than most entire countries.
Earth Day was April 22nd, and as the converging crises of climate, dwindling fresh water supplies, and planetary pollution mount, we devote this hour to exploring the link between imperialism and the environment.
More than 15,000 abandoned uranium mines, you know, throughout the country, primarily in the northern Great Plains, to pollute communities. They get into the agricultural industry, so they're indirectly polluting all of us in the country.
Whether it is war and the devastating impact of the U.S. military or continued violation of the lands of indigenous people, the imperialist drive to squeeze remaining natural resources from the earth is contributing to the collapse of global ecosystems and the spread of new pandemics.
We saw that corporations and governments were using the pandemic to push through development projects that had long been opposed by indigenous people.
And we'll learn about how this global system of exploitation is related to people struggling the world over, everything from the legacy of policing the formerly enslaved in the U.S., leading to last year's murder of George Floyd, to massive protests by Indian farmers, to the 2019 Bolivian coup, to the century-long genocide of people in the Congo.
They were not just willing to export the lithium, they made their own Bolivian government public sector battery-operated car, which Mr. Morales drove off the lot, you know, when it was first produced, and then he was overthrown.
From Pacifica Radio, this is COVID, Race, and Democracy. I'm your host, Esther Ivarum. We start this story in history, and to help us is the prolific author and activist Gerald Horn, professor of history and African American studies at the University of Houston. Welcome back to the show, Gerald.
Thank you.
Well, two of your recent history books, both Dawning of the Apocalypse, The Roots of Slavery, White Supremacy, Settler Colonialism, and Capitalism in the Long 16th Century, and The Apocalypse of Settler Colonialism, The Roots of Slavery, White Supremacy, and Capitalism in the 17th Century, North America and the Caribbean, document the impact on populations around the world in the run-up to the development of capitalism. But it feels like for this show on imperialism and the environment, we need to jump ahead to how the beginnings of this process provided the launching pad for the Industrial Revolution. So I know there are many possible points of entry that we can make, thinking about reading about enslaved men used to clear trees and stumps of virgin forest in North America, or how in 1887, cyanide was first used to mine gold in New Zealand. But I wonder what would be an important historical marker for you, or markers, plural, in this process of slavery, genocide, white supremacy, and capitalism impacting the environment?
Well, I think it was appropriate for you to start with the deforestation process, that is to say, chopping down trees. Entire forests were destroyed in order to clear land for agriculture, in order to have lumber to build ships, to transport settlers, and also to transport enslaved Africans. There was lumber used to build homes as well. But what's striking is how this deforestation obviously contributed to flooding when you take these trees from the soil. It's also important to note that deforestation led to loss of habitat for animals, and deforestation continues to this very day. Already, the Amazon rainforests are under threat. And it's also important to mention overfishing. Overfishing is a major issue today, particularly off the west coast of Africa, from Senegal to Cape Town. But this is nothing new. That is to say, imperialist countries sailing into African waters and stealing away with their fish is a historic process that has only accelerated in recent years.
So, speaking of these many points of entry, I was thinking that tracing the history of the exploitation of oil must be one entry that we have to cover on the environment today.
Well, certainly. Oil has been called the devil's excrement, and that's particularly important to note when you consider the role of Texas in the oil industry in the United States. It's no accident that Texas not only has been a major oil producer, but a major source of right-wing politics and a major source influencing U.S. foreign policy up to and including the disastrous Iraqi War of 2003, spearheaded by Texan George W. Bush, then U.S. president, with regard to the zealotry in Saudi Arabia, a major oil producer, which then uses the proceeds to fund religious zealotry, not least in Africa, with regard to petrochemicals and how petrochemicals are a major offspring of petroleum and the oil industry and has contributed to a cancer alley, as it is called in Texas's neighbor, speaking of Louisiana. Fortunately, there is a movement to move away from fossil fuels like petroleum, particularly on college campuses, pressing the universities to divest their endowments from oil companies like ExxonMobil, because otherwise they're going to be stranded assets, as they're called. That is to say, ExxonMobil in particular is losing money hand over fist, and it's just wise economically and financially as we move towards more serious engagement with climate change to move away from fossil fuels like petroleum.
When I was preparing for this segment, I've had to sort out in my mind whether colonialism is considered part of primitive accumulation or is it part of the imperialist project? And it seems to me that it's like both, that slavery, genocide, and colonialism provided the was turned into capital by the United States and Europe, but also it's part of the imperialist project on the other end of the expansion of capitalism.
Well, you are correct. Particularly, it's appropriate to note that point you're making when we speak from the United States of America. We can speak of the United States of America in its early iteration as a prison house of nations. That is to say, a premier colonial enterprise with Native American nations in particular being subjected not only to persecution, but ultimately liquidation. And then after that process reaches a certain point, you see an expansion overseas to overthrow the Hawaii Kingdom in the 1890s, to deliver a knockout blow to the tottering Spanish Empire in the Philippines in 1898, to engage in neocolonialism in Cuba by once again ousting the Spanish during that same historical period. So it is appropriate to speak of colonialism appearing in many different guises.
Well, one thing that I know we want to accomplish in this little mini series on imperialism is to cover different aspects of it, but not silo them. So when I think about the 10 to 15 million Congolese killed under the reign of Belgian King Leopold II in his rabbit hunt for rubber and other resources, you know, I hesitate to separate the impacts on the environment in the Congo from the better documented impact on the people there. So what are some of the ways you think that we can connect these impacts and not silo them?
Well, consider a precursor of the petroleum industry, that is to say, whaling, where the fluid from whales was used to light lamps. This devastated the whales in the oceans. Ultimately, as petroleum began to take off, you had whaling ships disguised as slave ships, that is to say, slave ships disguised as whaling ships, I should say, which therefore had an impact on people. And then when you look at oil in particular and how it has had ecologically devastating impact, particularly in Nigeria, where the oil regions are also heavily poisoned, which has obviously led to high mortality rates. If you look at the destruction of the rainforests in the Amazon, this is obviously having significant impact on the indigenous populations of that region in Brazil. And if you look at the pollution of water, which is a major environmental problem right now, you need only look at what's going on in Flint, Michigan, where the water supply was poisoned and polluted, which has led to enhanced mortality. Not to mention air pollution, for example, in western Louisiana and southeast Texas, which has had a devastating impact in terms of asthma rates and mortality and injury from asthma in that part of the United States of America.
Well, we have to cover so many aspects of not only the environment in this series, but also, you know, even the impact of war and these imperialist wars and the devastating impact that they have on the environment. So we're going to cover all those. But finally, I want to ask you, as an historian who studies the current events that you've mentioned already, and as a father, what do you think are the promising points of resistance to imperialism's continued destruction of the climate that permits human survival?
Well, obviously, we need to speak about the Sunrise Movement in the United States of America, which has had a positive impact during its brief incarnation. We need to speak about the global movement to save the rainforest, the world's lungs, speaking of the Amazon. We need to speak about the movement in Nigeria, already made reference to, how people are campaigning against the fossil fuel industry there. There are many, many movements, fortunately, and that's what gives us hope and optimism.
Okay. Well, I've been speaking to Gerald Horn, professor of history and African American studies at the University of Houston. One of his recent books is Dawning of the Apocalypse, The Roots of Slavery, White Supremacy, Settler Colonialism, and Capitalism in the Long 16th Century. Thank you again, Gerald.
Thank you.
For more than 500 years, white supremacist genocide against indigenous peoples and the settler colonial theft of their resources has fueled the U.S. empire that now threatens the survival of all life on our planet. Today, indigenous land and water defenders are at the forefront of protecting the global environment that every single human being depends on for life. The International Indian Treaty Council has been one of the leading organizations courageously advocating for the rights and sovereignty of indigenous peoples and for the health of global ecosystems. Andrea Carmen, the council's executive director for the past 30 years, had this conversation with Pacifica producer Ken Yale.
The International Indian Treaty Council was founded in 1974 on the Standing Rock Reservation. The meeting was attended by about 5,000 indigenous delegates from throughout the Americas, not just from the US and Canada. And it was the culmination of a time of a lot of conflict and resurgence of indigenous peoples, fishing rights struggles in the late 1960s on the Pacific coast, occupation of Alcatraz Island in 1969, Wounded Knee, longest walks across the country, occupation of the BIA building, court cases, a lot of people arrested and even killed. And at the meeting, the call was made to seek a seat with the family of nations at the United Nations because there was really no justice for indigenous peoples within what's called the justice systems or legal systems of the settler governments that were more than anything part of the problem of the human rights violations, land rights, treaty rights, cultural destruction of our sites. And in 1977, we helped organize the very first United Nations Conference of Indigenous Peoples focused on racial discrimination against Indigenous peoples of the Americas. And that same year, the IITC received what's called consultative status with the United Nations Economic and Social Council. We don't just work in the area of human rights now. We work in food sovereignty, climate change, biodiversity, environmental protection, a lot of the different international branches and arenas. We've been able to make a lot of progress there. It took us 30 years, but we were able to achieve in 2007 the adoption by the UN General Assembly of the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples, recognizing our collective rights as peoples. recognizing our treaty rights, our land rights, that right to self-determination. We have affiliates and members, nations, tribes, organizations, traditional treaty councils, networks that make up the IITC, all the way from Arctic Village, Alaska to Argentina, throughout the Americas, out on the Pacific Islands and out to the Caribbean. So this is our representation, 5 different regions of Indigenous peoples that speak with a unified voice and work with Indigenous peoples from around the world to defend our rights and recognize the rights and struggles of our peoples in our own homelands.
Wow, that is really powerful and so inspiring. Let's focus in now on Indigenous land and water defenders who have been subjected to absolutely brutal attacks by corporate and imperial interests around the world. And these assaults have been getting even worse in the pandemic, haven't they?
They absolutely have. Everybody knows that Indigenous peoples were especially hard hit by the pandemic, but not only because of lack of access to healthcare, but in many cases, it was because of decades or even centuries of environmental degradation on their lands that was exposing them to mining waste, nuclear fallout, toxic chemicals, pesticide sprays, you know, all of these different factors that had actually negatively impacted their ability for resistance. Another factor was the debilitation of Indigenous peoples' traditional food systems and food sovereignty. Everybody knows the high rates of diabetes and other kinds of diseases, cancers we suffer, and a lot of it is because now we don't have access to our traditional foods or waters and lands, or these essential elements for survival are contaminated. It wasn't just here, it's in other countries as well, where Indigenous peoples have been the target of resource extraction with no concern for the environmental contamination left behind, the uranium mining here in the Southwest. And I mentioned the pesticide spraying affecting our Yaqui communities just across the border in Mexico, where you know all the kids have asthma during the time of year that the crops are being sprayed, many times with pesticides that have been banned for use by the exporting country, like the United States, you know, Monsanto and Bayer Crop Science in Germany. At the same time, we saw that corporations and governments were using the pandemic to push through development projects that had long been opposed by Indigenous peoples for the very reasons I'm talking about, because of the environmental contamination, because of destruction of sacred sites. Those were some of the reasons that we strongly supported the water rights defenders at Standing Rock and took that case as an urgent action to the United Nations to help get international attention around what was going on there. But, you know, not just in the United States, in Brazil, in Colombia. In Colombia, we heard during the first 6 months of the pipeline, over 30 Indigenous human rights defenders had been killed. We saw the government of Brazil pushing through deforestation and major fires and basically displacing Indigenous peoples from their land, and a lot of human rights defenders being killed there too. This is not the first pandemic we've suffered, of course. Everyone remembers the smallpox blankets and flu and measles and other things that decimated many Indigenous nations. So it's really important that Indigenous peoples be included in developing programs, including taking into account our traditional healing methods and traditional health knowledge. I'm right now the co-chair of a new United Nations body at the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change, which is ironic because that was probably one of the worst bodies for our participation over the years. We were not even allowed in the room, and we're there to challenge the policies of the countries. The Paris Agreement calls for recognition of the rights of Indigenous peoples in all climate actions, which include the causes like pipelines, like fossil fuel development, the impacts on our homelands, as well as false solutions like carbon trading. So we're really for the first time really at the table in a UN body discussing the impacts of climate change, because everybody knows that indigenous peoples are on the forefront. Some of our island peoples have already had to move. They have no more fresh water. All of our food systems are impacted, but let's see if they listen to us. Let's see if they really understand our point of view about a radical change in their policies, in their practices, and in the dependence that the states and corporations continue to push on the fossil fuel economy, which causes climate change more than any other thing.
And I think they'll really only listen when many more of us rise up and join in the battle. So where can people go to learn more or to get active in building solidarity with the movements of Indigenous peoples?
Well, we have a website and we post regular updates there about Indigenous people's struggles, www.iitc.org. But maybe the most important is just to find out what Indigenous struggles are happening in each of your areas, where Indigenous peoples are maybe not well known, a struggle to protect a burial ground or sacred site or get land back, you know, fight a corporation. The most important is find out what Indigenous peoples are doing in your area. We really appreciate the interest in the perspectives and concerns of Indigenous peoples, but also we have solutions that we hope that the world will look at and take to heart and respect our knowledge systems and food systems and what we can offer the world community for a different approach to their relationship with Mother Earth and to other peoples that may look differently than themselves. We hope that those things can be taken to heart.
That was Andrea Carmen, Executive Director of the International Indian Treaty Council. You can link to her full interview with producer Ken Yale on our webpage at covidtaskforce.pacifica.org. This is COVID, Race, and Democracy on Pacifica Radio. Stay with us.
Stand up with the First Nations and our people that have been living here for thousands of years.
Stand up.
We've been fighting for our freedom since the Nina and the Pinta and the Santa Maria.
Stand up.
Like Geronimo, Sitting Bull, Red Cloud, Crazy Horse, Lennon Peltier.
Stand up.
Now they poisoning the waters for our sons and our daughters, so we on the frontier.
We
one nation, one cause, one people, one tribe. Now it's us against the pipeline. Get on your feet for Standing Rock and we'll show you how strong we could be when we unify.
To all my native people, recognize yourself, keep your head up.
Planet Earth, it's been spinning, we've been living and dying, but giving birth the first of many nations, celebrating them days when all that got made came after what
God made.
These days we cater to these internet memes, internet streams, it seems them streams aren't clean.
I mean,
we need the whole story seen. We're hassling before water has gasoline in it.
Malcolm X. As more and more colonized peoples fought for liberation and won independence after World War II, imperialists developed new forms of global domination and profiteering. U.S. imperialism's drive to control the world's oil and strategic energy resources is now a leading cause of imperial wars, global impoverishment, and ecological destruction. Vijay Prashad is director of the Tricontinental Institute for Social Research and chief correspondent for Globetrotter. He spoke with Pacifica producer Ken Yale about the impact of imperialism on the world's nations, peoples, and environment.
What does it mean to say that the U.S. is an empire or an imperialist nation?
So when a country has no political sovereignty any longer, it has no economic sovereignty, no social sovereignty. And so that's colonialism. But what happens if you have a situation where the British say, well, we're going to leave Nigeria, we're going to have you be independent, but there's still an overwhelming power over the country. So imperialism is this extra economic force, the use of debt, the use of sometimes direct intimidation and threat to gain economic advantages for both the countries of the North and northern-based multinational corporations. You know, it's a very complicated process, but it has a simple aim, which is to make sure that the vast bulk of the billions of the planet, their standard of living is kept down to maintain their wage levels down to mean they can be super exploited in a global system that advantages multinational corporations.
What are a couple other key levers in that transition from direct colonial rule to imperial control?
There's a range of things. That financing for development, that's a huge part of the way in which countries are constrained. But it's not the only way, you know. Your government might be overthrown. You tried to nationalize your oil in Iran in 1953. Mohammad Mossadegh's government is overthrown. You tried to do land reforms, modest land reforms in Guatemala, which impinges on United Fruit, which is an American fruit company. Your government is overthrown. The government of Jacob Arbenz, 1954. Intimidation, gunboat diplomacy, coup d'etats, you know, threats against people, assassination and so on. That's also part of the imperialist project. And then, you know, anytime a group of countries came forward to propose an alternative, there was a kind of information war used against them. You delegitimize these countries, you say they're authoritarian, you say that they are against the free market. I mean, give you an example. There are all kinds of cartels that Western companies have in place, including today in the middle of COVID-19 pandemic. You've essentially got a cartel of manufacturers of vaccines lobbying in the World Trade Organization to prevent a waiver from being put forward that allows, you know, no patents for the COVID-19 vaccines. So they can operate as a cartel, that's fine. But when countries of the global south try to get together, they're called authoritarian, they're called dictatorships, they are said to be against free market principles and so on. And then you have a kind of information war. You know, what CNN says, well, it's in fact what the State Department, U.S. State Department says, what the U.S. State Department says is what CNN says. And then what CNN says is what media outlets around the world sometimes say. And that produces a kind of information suffocation, you know, that prevents alternative projects from being taken seriously.
And then, of course, we have sanctions.
The U.S. government, against the U.N. Charter, has developed its own agenda of sanctions. It is currently sanctioning over 30 countries. Most countries rely on the U.S. dollar to reconcile their trade. Because of that, the United States is able to close off access to the dollar to some countries, and that produces enormous problems for countries. But sanctions are not only financial, because, you know, you can then blockade a country, you can prevent trade from coming in and out. You can stop things that a country might need to import, saying these are dual-use technology and so on. It has a military impact. You can weaken a country's resolve, and then eventually it's easy to overthrow a country, which is why I say sanctions is somewhere between financial warfare and direct warfare.
You had mentioned some of the early history about how a major driver of imperialism is the desire to profit from and control the world's energy resources and strategic minerals. And I'm wondering if you could summarize some of the ways that this is driving policy.
People go to war for a reason. They would like you to believe that their reasons are high-minded, you know, human rights, democracy, and so on. But look, when it comes down to it, they seem to go to war for human rights in countries that have a lot of important resources. Well, the plain fact is they don't go to war in places like Iraq for human rights reasons. They go to war to control the oil. It's not to seize the oil. The issue is that these countries should not be independent. They should not drive an independent policy regarding their oil or any other mineral or raw material or anything like that. I mean, look, there was a coup in November 2019 against Evo Morales. Part of the reason for that coup is Bolivia is chock full of very important precious minerals, metals, and so on, including indium. Indium is crucial. Indium is what produces the screens on computers. Bolivia is one of the world's largest known holdings of indium. Lithium, you know, between Argentina, Bolivia, and Chile, these three countries, A, B, C, have the world's biggest lithium fields. The government of Evo Morales of Bolivia had developed the ability to process the lithium into batteries. They were not just willing to export the lithium. They made their own Bolivian government public sector battery-operated car, which Mr. Morales drove off the lot, you know, when it was first produced. And then he was overthrown very soon after. See, that's what's unacceptable. It's not that, you know, you can't have lithium and you can't mine the lithium. It's just that you can't have independent control of it. And they use intimidation, financial warfare, and so on to intimidate you into surrendering control over your precious raw materials to them. I think that's what this game is about. In this situation of an imperialist world order, exercise of sovereignty is what is treated as illegal.
Then what is the ultimate impact on the people when they lose their control? What's the ultimate price that the people pay?
In 1961, if Patrice Lumumba had been able to become the leader of his government in the Congo, if he had been able to then properly harness the resources of that vast and very rich country, the most important ones were the copper of the Katanga province. Eventually, southern Congo would have been developed for its cobalt and coltan and so on. If they had been able to develop this in a socially responsible fashion, be stewards of nature and so on, you may not have had the Congo what it is today. Look at the price. You're asking the price. The country is in poverty. The sovereignty of the country is greatly compromised. Eastern half of the Congo near Goma is half the time under the control of Rwanda. You've got immense problems in the north, in Burundi. I mean, the problems, one country after the other, destabilized by the fact that there was the assassination of Patrice Lumumba in 1961 by Belgian and US intelligence services. Look at Zambia. Zambia and Zimbabwe, as the two halves of Rhodesia, fought very brave liberation struggles against the British. Zambia was northern Rhodesia, a country with immense copper holdings. Copper is essential for wiring. Copper is essential for, well, the computers via which we are talking right now. There's a part of Zambia called the Copper Belt, and in the Copper Belt, 60% of children are illiterate. That's the price that people pay for not being able to exercise their sovereignty.
How is U.S. imperialism impacting global ecosystems? And what does that mean for the future of all life on the planet?
There is this ravenous way in which capitalism moves towards the commodification of everything. And the more you commodify it, the less respect there is for the limits to growth. The less you appreciate that there are limits in the environment, limits in nature and so on, the more you will continue to destroy the planet. So there is an inbuilt tendency in capitalism to basically turn everything into an opportunity to make money. Well, that's the doom of the planet. You'll see more and more small island states be rattled by the changes in the climate, which are entirely induced by capitalism. You're already seeing turbulent weather patterns. You know, we see the shift in cropping patterns quite dramatically, driven by, you know, the increase of cash cropping. I mean, there's maybe up to a billion people who struggle with starvation every day. Half the world's population struggles with one form of hunger or the other. But there is a general tendency where we're losing acreage, we're losing arable land to some extent to real estate, but much more so towards fuel, towards growing food for animals. Half the population doesn't get to eat the increased livestock that's produced. Imperialism has produced a wretched world order. You know, it always will have to cover itself in the language of human rights or in the language of liberalism or something like that. But let's face it, let's get to the heart of it. Let's rip off the blanket with which it covers itself. And underneath that, what you see is this profit motive. It's very ugly.
I'm wondering if there are any movements or organizations that you find especially inspiring.
The Chavistas of Venezuela, the people who are holding fast against this non-stop attempted overthrow of the government. I admire the Cubans very much. Under great stress, they continue to build their public health systems, their public education systems. They are not exporting arms. They don't bomb countries. They send doctors around the world. I admire the farmers' organizations in India now. After, you know, 30, 40 years of building a movement, they have been sitting there in mass protest since 26 November 2020, non-stop protest against the Indian government. That is highly admirable. I mean, look, the point I want to make is that building organizations takes a lot of effort, a lot of energy, a lot of patience. It's not something that is a flash in the pan. You have to admire people for having the fortitude, for having the patience to build platforms of the working class and the peasantry. I admire people like that. I admire the platforms they build.
That was Vijay Prashad, director of Tricontinental Institute for Social Research. You can link to his full interview with producer Ken Yale on our webpage at covidtaskforce.pacifica.org.
Sun is sitting in the treetops, burning the woods, and it's a flame from the blaze, yeah, higher round higher. They say, don't drink the water, we need it for the fire. New York is drinking it, no, all of California is drinking it, no, way up north and down south is drinking it, no, used to have minerals and zinc in it, no, now they say it got lead and stink in it, no, fluorocarbons and monoxide, push the water table lopsided, used to be free, now of course you will feed, cause all things fully loaded, they roll across the sea. Man, you gotta cook with it, baby, clean with it.
That's right.
When it's hot summertime, you fiend for it.
No.
You gotta put it in the iron you steaming with.
That's right.
It's what they dress, move, and treat diseases
Shout
with. The rich and poor, black and white got need for
That's
it.
Right.
And everybody in the world can agree with
Let
this. Consumption promotes health and easiness.
That's
Go
right.
too long without it on this earth and you leaving
Shout it.
It
out.
Americans wasting it on some leisure. Another nation be desperately seeking it. Bacteria washing up on their beaches.
Say
don't drink the water so they can't wash their feet with it. Young babies in perpetual neediness.
Say
epidemics hopping up the petri dish. Control center shot to play all secret
it.
To avoid public panic and freakiness.
Let
there are places where TB is common as TV. Cause foreign based companies go and get greedy. The type of cats who pollute the whole shoreline. Have it purified and sell it.
For COVID, Race, and Democracy, I'm Esther Evarim, continuing on this special show devoted to imperialism and the environment. And our next guest is Dr. Margaret Flowers, a pediatrician and veteran human rights activist who is co-founder of the website Popular Resistance. She also hosts the show Clearing the Fog on Pacifica Radio, and she is national coordinator of the Health Over Profit for Everyone campaign. She has been on the front lines for local, national, and international campaigns for healthcare, economic, and environmental justice. Welcome to the show, Margaret.
Thank you for having me, Esther.
Well, we wanted to talk to you about imperialism at home because it's usually thought of as only negatively impacting the world beyond the borders of the U.S. or beyond the borders of imperialist capitalist countries. But I know you've been on the front lines on many environmental battles here in the United States. So we want to talk to you about what have been some of the major impacts of U.S. imperialism, multinational corporations on the environment inside this country or inside other capitalist nations.
Yes, I'm really glad that you're bringing up this topic of how U.S. imperialism impacts people at home. From an environmental perspective, we can start out by recognizing that the U.S. military is the largest polluter and largest user of fossil fuels in the world. And so that's driving the extraction industry, which, you know, under the Obama administration, the Obama-Biden administration, they worked to make the United States the biggest exporter of fossil fuels. And all that extraction that's happening across the country through fracking, for oil and gas through drilling, that's primarily, you know, impacting low-income communities, black and brown communities. And not only is it, you know, polluting the earth, but it's also polluting the air. And so that air pollution is causing deaths. It's weakening our health. And so when we see these racial disparities in how people are doing in terms of the COVID-19 pandemic, we have to recognize that one part of the reason for those racial disparities is the impact of this environmental pollution on communities, on the health of people in these communities. So that's just some of the ways that, you know, that the military is hurting us environmentally.
Right. And, you know, it's so interesting that you mentioned the military because we devoted a special segment to talk about that. But I'm also thinking about plastic. Earth Day was April 22nd. And one of the things that a lot of groups are dealing with now is the fact that the plastics corporations have basically been lying to people for decades now about how plastic is recyclable and basically blaming Americans for the waste. You know, it's our fault, as opposed to the fact that they've known that these plastics really aren't recyclable.
Right. And also there was a recent report that showed that every step of the way, producing plastic, using plastic, then disposing of it, all of this has, you know, environmental and health impacts and, you know, and is really just devastating, not only to people, but to the planet and to other life on the planet. So there's really starting to be more of a louder call to ban plastics completely because of the danger that they pose.
So there are so many points of entry in terms of the environmental crisis. But if you had to pick, you know, one, if you had to pick the most egregious or dangerous example of what's happening with multinational corporations impacting us here at home, what would it be?
Well, I think, you know, what I would like to mention is one that is just very egregious, but it's not talked about hardly. And that is the uranium industry in the United States, and this whole history that many people don't know about of the, you know, 50s and 60s, 1950s, 1960s being the uranium rush, when the Atomic Energy Commission basically put out, you know, the call that it would buy any uranium that people could dig up. And so we have now more than 15,000 abandoned uranium mines, you know, throughout the country, primarily in the northern Great Plains and the western parts of the country, where corporations just went out and started digging these open pit uranium mines, taking the ore, and then just leaving them, abandoning them without any cleanup. And so they're continuing to pollute communities. They get into the agricultural industry, so they're indirectly, you know, polluting all of us in the country who get our food from the breadbasket of the United States. And now the uranium industry is moving into a type of fracking that is also poisoning the water. It can't be done safely. And so this is something that, you know, we talk about fossil fuel extraction all the time, but we also need to recognize that nuclear power is also a very dirty source of energy, and that, you know, we should be opposing that in addition to fossil fuels.
So when I met you, one of the stories that I was working on that, you know, you were working, you know, as an activist here in the D.C., Maryland, Virginia area, was the issue of fracking. And in Cove Point, Maryland, there was a real effort, grassroots effort, to oppose the construction of this export terminal for either fracked natural gas or fracked oil. And I think that the community lost that time. But do you want to talk a little bit about what we've lost as a country because of this whole fracking?
Oh, absolutely. You know, there's so much evidence now that we know how harmful it is to health. And the reason that we were, you know, one of the reasons we were fighting the export terminal in Southern Maryland is that it was going to just drive fracking throughout the Northeast. So it wasn't just impacting Maryland, but all these other states that have, you know, gas that where fracking is happening, that was just going to like really drive that in the whole region and cause impacts to those communities as well. And we know that there's no safe way to do fracking, that they're injecting chemicals into the ground at high pressures. This has all kinds of impacts. It's also, as they pull up the gas from out of the ground, it brings up radiation and heavy metals and those types of things. It gets into the water supplies. And I've talked with farmers in Pennsylvania who have completely lost their farms because their livestock died due to fracking. Their own health suffered severely because of fracking. The earthquakes associated with fracking caused devastation to the structures on their property. We know that there are, you know, fracking rigs literally close to elementary and, you know, middle schools that are then having an impact on the health of the, you know, youth, the students there at those schools. It's really egregious that this is happening the way it is when we know the health impacts of this, and we know that renewable, clean sources of energy are something that we can use. They're less expensive and they're healthier for everybody, for the workers and the whole community. But yeah, there's been, you know, this whole huge drive. And then just thinking about, you know, so much of like U.S. imperialism, it's over resources, right? And so, you know, it's oil wars, it's gas wars, but also now we're polluting our water in the United States, and we're starting to get into water wars. I think a big part of the U.S.'s attacks on Venezuela is that it's also one of the largest sources of fresh water in that region. So, you know, these are all connected and they're all driving us in a very dangerous direction.
I've spoken to you many times during the pandemic as a doctor, as a pediatrician. And so right now, you know, as the U.S. is experiencing this continued health and economic crisis, you know, what kind of links can we make about the practices of multinational corporations impacting us, particularly right now during the pandemic? I mean, I don't know whether it was last week or recently, just looking at the number of corporations that aren't paying taxes at the same time that we don't have a public health system right now. I mean, that's a connection that I've been thinking about, but what do you think?
Well, I mean, that's been a long-term issue of these major corporations not paying any taxes. It's, you know, we have to remind ourselves that all these things that we need, you know, healthcare, education, housing, jobs with living wages, investment in repairing our infrastructure, moving to a green economy, all of these things, we as one of the wealthiest nations in the world can afford these. We know we have the money, but it's where is that money going? And it's going into the top, you know, 0.1% and these huge corporations that get all kinds of subsidies, tax breaks, infrastructure that the government builds for them that they don't have to pay for, providing, you know, healthcare and food support and things for their workers because they don't pay them adequate wages. These corporations are really, they're not just extracting, you know, resources, they're extracting the wealth from this country. They're stealing from the people, really, if you think about it. And this is preventing us from being able to provide basic services that many other, even poorer countries, if you think about places like Cuba, Nicaragua, where I recently traveled, they're able to provide these things for their people because that's what they prioritize. And here in the United States, it's really money that dominates our political system. The political system serves the elite interests, and you know, and that's really a big root cause of why we're a failed state right now.
Mm-hmm. Well, I want to thank you. I've been speaking with Dr. Margaret Flowers, pediatrician and veteran human rights activist. You can check out her writings and other information at popularresistance.org. Thank you, Margaret.
Thank you, Esther.
How can we stand aside? Watch the rape of the world. It's the beginning of the end. It's the most heinous of crimes. It's the deadliest of
Since 2016, the organization World Beyond War has sponsored an annual No War conference. No War 2017 was a three-day event at American University in Washington, D.C., dedicated to war and the environment. This is David Swanson, co-founder and executive director of World Beyond War, speaking at the opening plenary.
During World War I, we should note, the U.S. Army used land that is now a part of the campus we are on to create and test out chemical weapons. Then it buried what Karl Rove might have called vast stockpiles underground, left, and forgot about them until a construction crew uncovered them in 1993. The cleanup is ongoing with no end in sight. One place the Army used tear gas was on its own veterans when they came back to D.C. to demand bonuses. Then, during the Second World War, the U.S. military dumped huge quantities of chemical weapons into the Atlantic and Pacific Oceans. In 1943, German bombs sank a U.S. ship at Bari, Italy, that was secretly carrying 1 million pounds of mustard gas. Many of the U.S. sailors died from the poison, which the United States said it was using as, quote, a deterrent, though it did not explain how something deters while kept secret. That ship is expected to keep leaking gas into the sea for centuries. Meanwhile, the U.S. and Japan left over 1,000 ships on the floor of the Pacific, including many fuel tankers. There are 6 Superfund sites poisoning the Potomac River not far from here. They are all military sites. They are poisoning the Potomac with everything from acetone, alkaline, arsenic, anthrax, on down to vinyl chloride, xylene, and zinc. 69% of Superfund sites across the United States are military bases. And this is the country for which this military is supposedly performing some sort of so-called service. What the U.S. military and other militaries do to the Earth as a whole is unfathomable, or at least unfathomed. The U.S. military is the top consumer of petroleum around, burning more than most entire countries. I'm probably going to skip the U.S. Army's upcoming 10-miler in D.C., at which people will be, quote, running for clean water. Water in Uganda, supposedly. For a fraction of just what Congress just increased U.S. military spending by, we could end the lack of clean water everywhere on Earth. And any race in D.C. had better stay away from any rivers if it doesn't want to come into contact with what the U.S. Army actually does to water. What war and war preparations do to the Earth has always been a hard topic to get at. Why would those who care about the Earth want to take on the beloved and inspiring institution that brought us Vietnam, Iraq, the famine in Yemen, torture at Guantanamo, and 16 years of gruesome slaughter in Afghanistan, not to mention the gleaming eloquence of President Donald J. Trump? And why would those who oppose the mass murder of human beings want to change the subject to deforestation and poisoned streams and what nuclear weapons do to the planet? But the fact is that if war were moral, legal, defensive, beneficial to the spread of freedom, and inexpensive, we would be obliged to make abolishing it our top priority solely because of the destruction that war and preparations for war do as the leading polluters of our natural environment. While converting to sustainable practices could pay for itself in healthcare savings, the funds with which to do it are there many times over in the U.S. military budget. One airplane program, the F-35, could be canceled and the funds used to convert every home in the United States to clean energy. We are not going to save our Earth's climate as individuals. We need organized global efforts. The only place where the resources can be found is in the military. The wealth of the billionaires does not even begin to rival it. And taking it away from the military, even without doing anything else with it, is the single best thing that we could do for the Earth. The madness of war culture has got some people imagining a limited nuclear war. While scientists say a single nuke could push climate change beyond all hope, and a handful could starve us out of existence, a peace and sustainability culture is the answer. Among societies that accept or promote war making, those consequences of environmental destruction will likely include yet more war making. It is, of course, false and self-defeating to suggest that climate change simply causes war in the absence of any human agency. There is no correlation between resource scarcity and war, or environmental destruction and war. There is, however, a correlation between cultural acceptance of war and war. And this world, and especially certain parts of it, including the United States, is very accepting of war, as reflected in the belief in its inevitability. Wars generating environmental destruction and mass migration generating more wars, generating further destruction is a vicious cycle we have to break out of by protecting the environment and abolishing war. Thank you.
Again, that was David Swanson speaking at the No War 2017 conference in Washington, D.C. Well, this concludes today's edition of COVID, Race, and Democracy. We'd like to thank all Pacifica stations and radio affiliates who contributed to the production of this show. Today's edition was produced by Esther Ivarim, Polina Vasiliev, and Ken Yale. Music this hour was by Los Babies, Taboo, Mos Def, and Tracy Chapman. I've been your host, Esther Ivarim. Thank you for listening. You can find this show posted at covidtaskforce.pacifica.org.